Many of you are familiar with Dr. Jenny Marazzo. She's a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Washington and has held a large list of leadership positions. Medical director of the FTD-PTC in Seattle, president of ASTDA for, I think, 4 years. That's quite a tenure. And also a great scientist, and led a study of pre-exposure prophylaxis, the VOICE study, but also is very interested in the vaginal and the genital microbiome and has contributed significantly to the literature. So she's going to come up and kind of update us on this very problematic condition for us clinicians to be dealing with.
So. When do you want me to finish, by the way? 14?
So we're going to give you a card at 12 minutes, 5 minutes, 17 minutes.
Okay, great. I'll talk really fast, which is not a problem. So Laura and Will, thank you so much, and thanks for your flexibility in scheduling this, because it was a little bit, I gave an unexpected talk in another session for my pregnant colleague, my advanced pregnant colleague. Okay, so very quickly, I think many of you in the room, but I know this is a mixed audience, so just in case you don't know, the classical spectrum of vaginal bacteria, we typically have used something called the Gram stain to assess this. On the right, you're seeing a Gram stain of normal vaginal fluid, which is heavily predominant with lactobacilli, those long purple things there. They are very specific human lactobacilli. They're not the lactobacilli that you get at the dairy. They're not Lactobacillus acidophilus or Delbrueckii or any of the reuteri ones that they give to kids for probiotics. They usually are Crispatus and Jensenii. When they are present in high numbers, you have a very good acidic vaginal pH, which is really critical for defense. And then when they're not present, you basically have commensal bacterial overgrowth with a very, very large mix of anaerobes that I'm going to talk about today. And that's really what defines BV. Scale this from a Nugent score of 0 in the perfect world to 7 to 10 when things go a little bit crazy. And that's when you tend to start to see adverse outcomes and symptoms. Now, it's really interesting to think about this from a teleologic standpoint. Really, why has the vagina evolved to be like this? What are the benefits of having this optimal vaginal environment? And you have to sort of surmise that they're primarily reproductive, since every baby until the advent of C-section was going through a vagina, right? So very clearly, the optimal birth outcomes that are driven by this normal vaginal flora almost certainly were the biggest evolutionary pressure to maintaining this acidic pH in this lactobacillus predominant environment. And indeed, if you look at cohort studies, you can relate normal birth weight, normal timing of delivery, and fewer pregnancy-associated infections to having this healthy vaginal environment. But really fascinating new research that's now being made possible by the microbiome study is showing that not only is this a function of having a good environment for defense of infection and other things, it's almost certainly a way that babies get maternal microbiota to colonize their own mucosal surfaces. And in fact, very interesting, I would say, nascent research is coming out now showing that babies born through the vaginal canal actually have lower rates of some autoimmune diseases like asthma and other metabolic disorders. And that may be in part mediated by colonization of these surfaces and the attendant immune response that the baby generates in response to these bugs. So it's really getting very interesting. And with more cohort studies that are collecting these samples frequently and then following the babies long term along with the moms, it's going to be quite cool. And I already mentioned protection from pathogens and dysbiosis. So when you have VV, this is what happens. You get abnormal discharge. You get an amine odor. About half of women are symptomatic. Many fail, 15 to 20%, the initial antibiotic regimen. And the real problem is that it recurs in the majority. About 75% of women will have recurrence over the course of a year. And this is what the discharge just looks like. So how can we use these new techniques to study the vaginal microbiome? And can it help us? They help us sort of figure out what's going on here. Now, again, this is a very straightforward, for those of you who are scared of 16S and molecular stuff in general, I'll make it very simple because I'm very simple about it. What has made this microbiome approach possible? Basically, what it's done is allow you to study these bugs without requiring that you grow them. And when you have anaerobes that are intensely dependent on not being around oxygen or oxygen intolerant, it's very hard to do that in the laboratory. So this allows you to detect them without actually having to grow up the bugs. And what the 16S RNA approach does is to rely on that gene. It's present in all bacteria. It codes for small subunits of ribosomal RNA that you absolutely have to have protein synthesis. And you can basically fish for these bacterial sequences using these sequences that they all have, and then you go in between those sequences to the variable sequences to actually define what the bacteria are. And that's really all it is. It's very simple. When you do this, you find a couple of surprising things. We first applied this to a number of women from our STD clinic and actually from some of the cohorts that Christina talked about this morning, from our Women of Sex with Women. And when we looked at women without BV, we anticipated that we would see a whole bunch of bacteria besides those lactobacilli that we already knew about from cultivation-based studies. But we didn't really. This is just a slide that shows you, it's a clonal analysis, but it basically gives you a sense of how often you saw these bacteria in these women who did not have BV. And it turned out that their microbiome was very homogeneous. They had an average of 3 species per subject, and it was mostly Lactobacillus crispatus. There was something called Lactobacillus inners, which was a little bit of a surprise, and we still don't understand what that is, but I'll come back to it. When we looked at women who had BV, in contrast, they had an average of 14 species per subject. So the species richness very much increased from what we used to think was just Gardnerella for the most part. We always knew Gardnerella happened. We always knew Prevotella happened, some strep, et cetera. But this was really amazing. And look at all these bugs that we found in these women using cultivation-independent techniques. And moreover, novel phylotypes, meaning bacteria that hadn't been well described or cultivated, comprised the majority of that library. So it was really kind of a bacterial wonderland down there. Very, very exciting. Not only can you sort of look at these bacteria by sequences, you can also design tools to visualize them, which is really very exciting. And these are fluorescence in situ photomicrographs, fish, which are very appropriately called fish, given that we're talking about BV. This is fluorescence in situ hybridization photomicrographs. Sorry. So that's an epithelial cell, and on the surface of the cell, you're seeing those green and red dots, and those are two bacteria that are doing just exactly what we do or see when we see clue cells. When you look in a vaginal wet prep, you see epithelial cells coated with bacteria. This is really a high-tech clue cell, and these two bacteria had never been described before, but clearly are acting just like those bacteria. And then I'll just kind of try to finish up this part of the talk by mentioning that we've now gone well beyond those initial stages of microbiome characterization. The latest thing is something called pyrosequencing, and without really describing it to you in detail, it lets you characterize the population broadly with much more detail, even more than what I showed you on that previous slide. And it's very good at detecting even minority species, which that previous method was not. When you apply pyrosequencing, and this actually is now looking at over 200 women from our STD clinic, so predominantly heterosexual women, in women without BV, and I'm going to show you a nice graphic in the next slide to really talk about this in a way that's more visual, we still find mostly Lactobacillus crispatus. We do have some Lactobacillus inners. And then another 2% really are just a mix of species, but they're all at pretty low levels. When you look at the pyrosequencing data, you get quite a lot of sequence reads, and you can see that Gardnerella vaginalis is still very predominant. It comprised a third of the sequence reads in this section. But you'll also see some bugs that I know Lisa Manhart really likes, like Leptotrichia and Cnethia sanguinens, very interesting names. So a lot of very different things. Now, how can you use this and take advantage of some new informatics and sort of classification pipeline approaches to make this maybe not make sense, but maybe get your interest and get you thinking about this? So one of my longstanding hypotheses has been that not all BV is the same, just like not all pneumonia is the same, not all cellulitis is the same, not all genital ulcer disease is the same. Clearly, if you're getting BV from having a lot of receptive oral sex, or you're getting it from a new male partner, or you're getting it from a partner who's uncircumcised, you probably are going to get exposed to different bugs, and you're probably going to have a different immune response. So in fact, when you look at this, I just want you to sort of take a look at this and explain it to you, and I'll take you through this. What you're looking at here is every single line in this slide, so as I mentioned, there were about 220 women, I think, in this study, represents an individual woman. And when you go over to that color chart, what you're seeing on the A column is whether she had the AMSL criteria positive for BV. So if she's green, she actually had, if she's red, she had AMSL criteria positive, so she was probably a symptomatic patient. And if she's red in the N, that means her Nugent scores were positive for BV. So that whole top of the colored component are women who really have BV by both criteria. For the most part, you can see that they don't really separate very much. And look at the taxonomic composition, meaning the species detected in these women when they have BV. These are the bacterial taxa down here. I'll just point out that Gardnerella is actually in orange. Something called Agarthella is in green. Cnethia and Leptotrichia actually is that light green up there. And there's a whole bunch of other things. Lactobacillus crispatus, not surprisingly, is the orange down the bottom there, the dark orange sort of in the middle, and then that bottom orange is actually our friend Lactobacillus inners. So what the point of this slide, I think, is telling you is that not only do women with BV, as we already knew from cultivation, have diverse bacterial communities, they also seem to have some patterns within those communities. So if you look at that very top sort of tenth of that picture, you can see that that community in those women, and there probably are about 20 or 25 of them, really dominated by Sneathia, interestingly enough. Then if you go to, let's see if I can go back here, you go to a little bit farther down, and I apologize, I don't have a pointer, or is this it? Okay, great, thank you very much. So if you go down here, you can see that these folks are actually rather dominated by Gardnerella vaginalis. And then here, again, then over here, you see Sneathia again, you see some patterns of purple here, that's Megaspheris species. So we're in the process of carefully characterizing the risks of these women, because my guess is that they are going to differ in very key characteristics. It may be behavior, it may be innate immunity, who knows, it may be, we really do not know. So that's an important point. The other thing I think is interesting to note is that even though we talk about Lactobacillus crispatus as being a hallmark of a normal vaginal environment, you'll see that quite a lot of these women really did not have lactocrispatus as their predominant lacto. They have Lactobacillus inners. Lactobacillus inners doesn't really acidify the environment. It doesn't really make hydrogen peroxide. So what is it about these women that is allowing for a healthy environment, at least as measured by Nugent score and by AMSL criteria and lack of symptoms, without the presence of lactocrispatus? So a lot of questions raised, I think, by these data. Now, it gets even more complicated. That was a mere cross-sectional analysis, right? What about when you throw the very messy variable of time onto this? Because we know that these vaginal communities are really dynamic, just like our oral communities are and our gut communities are. And I'm not even talking about behavior yet. So I just want to show you two women, and these women don't even have BV. So just to make it even more complicated, this is an approach we've been taking to sort of summarize our studies. And what we've been doing has been sampling women, and increasingly men more frequently, and actually having women self-collect daily swabs vaginally and send them back to us in the mail. And that has worked quite well for PCR, qPCR detection. And now what I'm showing you is not the technique I showed you before, but it's quantitative PCR specifically for the individual bacteria. This is really sensitive, so this really allows you to get down probably to about 6 bacteria. So what you're seeing here is this is the threshold that we just arbitrarily use, about 100 bacteria, all the way up to almost over a billion, I guess that's a million, so almost a billion bacteria in the representative sample. And what you can see here is this participant starting on day 0, so she self-collected for 2 weeks every day, then she actually started to menstruate, that's what the red bar is there, and then she self-collected for 2 subsequent weeks. And she never had BV throughout this time period. Her Nugent score, at least as far as we know, so we didn't get Nugent scores the whole every day, but we have started to have women collect Nugent scores at home, and I'm happy to talk to you about that. Other people have done that too. But she, at least as assessed at baseline in 30 days, never had BV by Nugent score. In fact, had an absolutely perfect Nugent score. What did we see in terms of her Lactobacillus crispatus? This is actually her Lactobacillus crispatus, and you can see that she maintained, as you would expect, really beautiful high levels until right before she began to menstruate. And you see right here a really remarkable decline, and this is a log scale, so this is a serious decline in her lactocrispatus. And what comes up here and makes this sort of nefarious little appearance is Gardnerella vaginalis. And we've seen this in a number of women right before menses. There is this shift, and we don't know what it is. Is it hormonal? Is it the blood that's providing a signal to the bacteria to nourish the bacteria? We really don't know. So we're really interested in this, and one of our research projects that was just funded is going to be a very intensive look at the temporal dynamics of these bacteria. Josh Schiffer is going to do that. This other poor thing, on the other hand, she also never had BV. Look at this. Her Nugent score was 0, her Nugent score was 0, but she's like totally crazy all over the map. And maybe part of it is because we were doing daily sampling, or she was here, during her menstrual period. And so it's very clear. There are a whole bunch of species here. You see this, again, very similar pattern with Lactocrispatus. It goes back up, comes down, goes back up, and there's Gardnerella, it supersedes it, and then a whole bunch of other bugs here also happily thriving throughout the whole month, just not at quantities that are tipping her over the edge. So my point with this is that it's really very complicated when you start to put women with BV on this and you start to add changes in sexual behavior, you start to add antibiotics to this, it gets very, very complicated. So it's really a plea when you look at retrospective data about BV and you look at other studies, you know, it's really almost meaningless to look at BV every quarter even. So I know those data are valuable, they're the data we've relied on for prospective studies, but they're really limited. And I think future studies really need to go this route, and I know many in the room are very interested in that. The last thing I'll just talk about is why we should care about this. Why should this audience care, regardless of whether you're a clinician or an epidemiologist or a policy person? I talked about some of the pregnancy adverse outcomes, but really what has gotten the hardcore HIV people, I wouldn't say interested in BV, perhaps that's a little optimistic, but at least they don't leave the room when I talk about it, is this consistent association with HIV acquisition. So again, those limitations of those studies, notwithstanding that I mentioned, when you look at the risk associated with BV for HIV acquisition in almost all studies, including the African studies listed here, the risk is probably about 1.6, so a 60% increase in the risk of HIV acquisition. Well, if they don't care about women, talk about men and maybe they'll get interested, okay? So this slide now shows, this is not you in the room, you're sitting here. This slide now shows an even more interesting analysis that was recently published by Craig Cohen and Jared Baton and their group. And they actually had the cohort of HIV serodiscordant couples and were able to look at transmissions from HIV-infected women to HIV-uninfected men over 2 years and to study the woman's BV or flora status during the time that she participated in the study. And they knew when the partner seroconverted because they had enrolled both people in the study. And so it was a really very creative idea. What did they find? They actually found that when a woman had BV at the visit before the male partner was found to have seroconverted, the hazard ratio for him to have HIV detected was 3.6. And when they adjusted it, they tried very hard to make this go away. Look at what they adjusted for: age, geographic region, partner, herpes status, circumcision, randomization assignment. This was a study of Truvada or tenofovir for PrEP and STDs, as well as time-dependent covariates here, pregnancy, hormonal contraception, plasma RNA. You'd have to adjust for plasma RNA, unprotected sex, on and on and on. So they really tried harder to make it go away, and it just did not go away. Moreover, the biological plausibility of this hypothesis is strengthened when you look at BV severity. So current BV status, again, if you look at current BV status and the partner seroconverting, 5.3 was the ratio, adjusted 3.97. But then the most severe, meeting a Mnuchin score of 8 to 10, that hazard ratio was 7, and it stayed 7 in the adjusted analysis. So I think there's something to this. I don't know what it is. Is it that these men are transmitting these bacteria and eliciting an immune response that then increases the target cells for HIV? Is it that they are more likely to be infected with other infections that we may not even know about yet? I don't think we know. They controlled for the garden variety infections, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trich. But I think it's a fascinating finding. The obvious hypothesis is that it increased the woman's genital HIV shedding, right? And that would increase regardless of plasma RNA. Even if your plasma RNA was controlled, if you had genital increased shedding, then maybe you were more likely to be infectious. Of course, they looked at that, and indeed, the women who had BV did have a significant increase when they went from normal vaginal flora, almost significant, to intermediate and then on to BV, but it was very modest. It was 0.2 logs, and when you calculate the risk of transmission, this is not enough to account for the increased risk with BV. So it doesn't help, but it's not fully explaining what's going on here. So very, very interesting, and basically the only point I would make that is that in these cohorts and in our PrEP studies and in our microbicide studies, BV is incredibly common. So in this group, 35, 15, and 52% had BV at enrollment through follow-up and at least one time. So even if it's a relatively small attributable risk, the population attributable risk is likely to be low, very high. I think I'm supposed to stop. Right? So, yeah, you want me to wrap it up? Okay. So I will just say that we don't really know why women get or maintain BV, and I'll leave you with that. I like to think about it with as a host, as a pathogen, as the environment. I think that this thing that we are now talking about a biofilm is really critical. Gardnerella is an incredible biofilm. Bacteria really does well in biofilms, and it's almost certainly one of the reasons that this is hard to treat and women relapse. And then my last part just was going to talk about sex and BV, and I think Christina already set this up. I do think it's sexually transmitted in most women. The evidence is inconclusive, but I do think that the vaginal microbiome is probably defined in part by what you are exposed to. So it's really really probably a dysbiosis that depends on your partner's contribution. And I think I should probably stop there. If there are clinicians in the audience, I do have some slides on some treatment, upcoming treatment stuff, which is pretty cool. But I'm happy to stop there, and we can talk questions if we have time later.
One more minute of the treatment stuff.
Okay, sorry. I know, it was kind of a low blow of mine. I didn't mean to do that. Okay, so bottom line, more antibiotic is better. When I have these women with really recalcitrant to VV, I treat them for 2 weeks with generally topical therapy, and then suppression really does work. I think if you are exchanging vaginal fluid, if you have two women, preventing that, whether you use condoms or don't share sex toys, is really important. And then I think the boric acid regimen really works well, and that's listed there. That was published a couple of years ago. Why does boric acid work? Probably because it disrupts the biofilm. I'm almost certain that's why it is. So I've already talked to you about the research priorities and what are the new directions in BV treatment. The timing is great because I just got today from the STD Clinical Trials Group unit that this product called Lactin V, which is a probiotic of L-crispatus that I was actually involved in the first trial of many years ago, is actually now going to be studied for the treatment of recurrent BV again, which is really exciting. What else do we have? We have new formulation or forms of old drugs. Medicis has a bioadherent formulation of metronidazole that was recently studied, not public yet. There's a higher dosing regimen by Emble that has 375 milligrams of metronidazole along with clotrimazole as opposed to the 37 milligrams that we have in Metrogel, and that probably works very well. And then another product, secnidazole, which is similar to metronidazole. There's a Dendrimer gel that Star Pharma in Australia is actually promoting for BV. This is something we hoped would have HIV activity and does in vitro, and that could be very interesting, very novel product. And then again, the agents targeted to biofilm disruption, boric acid or similar agents, and ideally it would be great to target these with antibiotic drugs. So you disrupt the biofilm with boric acid and then you kill the bacteria. And again, I mentioned the lactin product. The nice thing about that is that it has been associated with, in one study, it affected a reduction in recurrent UTI. So I think it probably has a chance of working. And I think I will stop there and just acknowledge my wonderful study team and thank you for your attention. Sorry to go fast. I think I thought I had longer. I'm really sorry.
All right, those were wonderful talks. We've got maybe about 5 minutes for questions. So if you want to raise your hand, if you have questions, stand up, tell us who you are, speak loudly since we don't have a microphone, and then we'll have our different presenters repeat the question. All right, first one right up front here.
Well, first, three great talks. Thanks to all the speakers. Really very good. Question for Dr. Russell. About BV, what's your thought about the Gardnerella hypothesis? There's sort of a pro and a non-pro camp, and whether Gardnerella is
one
the...
One minute.
He gave me a time limit on answering the question. I think we don't know. I think you can't ignore Gardnerella. It's universal in BV and it's universal in biofilms. It has to play a fundamental role. Is it the pathogen that causes BV? No, because we don't always see it. It's not, and when we do see it, sometimes we don't see BV. It's a matter of quantity. So I think there is something there, but I don't know exactly what it is. We found it in the mouth. And we've found it in male flora, as have others, as Jane Schwedke in particular. So I think it's real. I just don't think it's sufficient to explain all BV.
More questions? Certainly, after all those great talks. Over here, yes.
Hi, Anna Leary from CBC. As for Lisa Manhart, you talked about the rapidity with which Amgen develops resistance, and I'm wondering whether that could be explained by having been co-occurring with other bacterial infections and already those latter being treated and then Amgen developing some resistance before it emerged.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think we know a lot about the mechanism. I think we are fairly convinced that it's not the antibiotics that are creating the mutations, that the mutations really are already present in the community, and that when you treat with azithromycin, you're just wiping out all of the bacteria that aren't resistant to it. Probably this is due just to widespread use of azithromycin in syndromic therapy for most of the other agents. Sometimes for known pathogens and sometimes just as syndromic therapy.
Don't sit down yet, Lisa. Actually, I want to ask you one other point, kind of a follow-up to this, is that on all those studies you showed in the women with the reproductive, the link with MGENT, are they controlling for chlamydia and other STIs when they're doing their associations? That seems it's hard to tease that apart.
Yeah, that's actually a really excellent question. And some studies did control for other known pathogens, and some studies did not. When we did the meta-analysis, we actually did it in two separate ways. In one, we took everyone together, which is what I presented, and then in another analysis, we restricted it to those studies that adjusted for other known pathogens, and the results were identical. So some do and some don't, but it really doesn't change the results.
Okay. One last question up front here, or maybe we'll get into. Yeah.
Hi, this question is for Jeannie, and I wanted to know what your feeling is. I'm a clinician working in a DOH contracted site. And what's your feeling about repeatedly treating females for BV when the only drug we have to use is metronidazole?
Oral metronidazole.
Yes.
Yeah, there are no data. Paul Nergesi uses a regimen. He's sort of, and maybe some of my more active British colleagues have some thoughts too, but I don't think they have time to talk. sorry. You know, 2 grams of metronidazole a week, 500 milligrams of metronidazole a week, probably 2 grams is too much. I think 500 a week might work. It's not been studied, and you know, metronidazole long-term can be toxic, particularly to nerves, so he's actually had to take a couple of women off because they develop sort of neuropathy symptoms. So I think, you know, it's a very tough challenge, and I think it's another reason it would be nice to have probiotic that really works.
So how many times do we treat before we stop?
Well, I would say, I mean, certainly treat recurrences a couple of times, right? And then if you don't have access to Metrogel, you could try the 500 a week, and if that works, go down, you know, to 250 a week and just try to keep, you know, it may just be a matter of suppressing it long enough to help their lactobacillus get a foothold. So I think it doesn't mean you're going to have to put them on metronidazole for 3 years. It may be a matter of assessing them every month, every quarter, and then trying to figure out. So that's probably what I would do, but there are no data.
Last question right here.
I was just going to ask, in this 16S ribosomal studies, are you going to be doing them over time and women that have BV that are treated with boric acid or treated with metronidazole just to see what the population?
Yeah, we absolutely have. I'm sorry. Yeah. So the question was, are we planning to, or have we looked at changes in the population by the type of treatment, whether it was different antibiotics or whether it was boric acid? We have not looked at the boric acid effect, but that's absolutely something that we would be really interested in, and hopefully there'll be a trial at some point of a product that is going to be like boric acid, and we would probably love to do that. We could save samples and do it. That's a nice thing about this. We don't have very much for clindamycin because we don't use it very often. Most of our women get treated with Metrogel, so topical metronidazole or oral metronidazole. So we really haven't looked very carefully at it. I think it would be worth doing.
So it might help you figure out which of these bacteria respond and don't respond of the big list there.
It could. It absolutely could. We did publish one paper that looked at pre-treatment detection of these bacteria as predictors of treatment failure with metronidazole gel, and several of the newly defined bacteria were culprits. And I think Gardnerella was not. And I think probably the worst, most intensive Clostridia-like anaerobes are going to be the ones that predict treatment failure, and we probably just need stronger, higher doses of more effective antibiotics to get them, plus the biofilm disruption so you can get to the Gardnerella, which does die when you get bugs drugs to it.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.